This is Whitley Strieber, and this is Dreamland. You've reached the edge of the world. A couple of months ago, we had an extraordinary experience on Dreamland with Grant Cameron. It was this really amazing visit. Grant has wired into a whole lot of things. We started out talking about one of the most remarkable UFO events in all of history, the Charlie Red Star UFO, and got so completely sidetracked that we hardly discussed it at all. But now, Grant's back, and we're going to go deep into Charlie Red Star and why it is such an amazing and important event. And then in the second half of the show, there's some new stuff about portals that's extraordinary that we're going to talk about as well. Grant Cameron, welcome back to Dreamland.
Well, Whitley, thank you very much. I really appreciate your interest in everything I'm doing.
Well, yeah, you're the real deal. You're a good researcher, and I'm always interested because not all researchers are good.
No.
In fact, quite a few researchers aren't so good. But anyway, okay, why don't you take us back to 1977, I believe it was.
Yeah, 75.
And, 75.
And this is basically my awakening experience. You had yours in the mid-80s. And it's everybody in the field that I've dealt with has one of these sort of experiences. And basically what happens is I'm going to university at the time and not interested in UFOs, not interested in extraterrestrial life, or at least can't remember having thought about it. But I was into weird stuff. I was into Edgar Cayce. When I was at university, I'd done an entire term paper on, or an entire course on one paper, which is I went to the hospitals and I would talk to chaplains and talk about dying patients and various stories like, do they ever predict their death? Does anybody ever come to greet somebody before they die? And that was when near-death experiences were first out. So I was asking about that, and I gathered all these sort of weird stories about people dying. So I was into weird stuff. And then what happened was, this is February of 1975, and 35 years later, I realized that it coincided with operation that was the only anti-ballistic missile unit that ever went operational in the United States, started the very same month in a town called Nakoma, North Dakota. So I'm on the Canadian side of the North Dakota border. And where all this stuff, the real heavy flap of sightings occurred from the border up to about maybe 40 miles north of the border. And in Nakoma, North Dakota, they had put this anti-ballistic missile unit. This was pre-Star Wars. When Reagan came in, he moved it to outer space. But in 1975, they had installed 100 new nuclear missiles in North Dakota. And these were to protect the 300 Minuteman nuclear missiles in North Dakota with the three warheads on them each. And the idea was that the primary target of the Soviets was not Washington, New York, or L.A. It was the missiles in North Dakota. Because unless you take out the missiles in North Dakota, you're not going to see what happens in Washington or New York. So they had installed these. Some of them were 5-megaton missiles. And what they were going to try to do is shoot down the Russian ICBMs in outer space. And then they had these real fast sprint missiles that they had installed. And if the big ones missed it, then they would try to get the missile as it was coming in to try to kill the missiles in North Dakota. So they started putting these in February of 1975 in North Dakota. And that's when the sighting started in Manitoba. And it was a pretty big deal. All the media was after this thing. There was TV cameras out there trying to film this thing. And this object was coming, maybe not every night, but fairly often. And the guy who ran the airport in this small town called Carman, Manitoba, I asked him, and he was a fairly famous aviator guy, but I asked him, I said, Bob, in how many sightings did you have in 75, 76? And he said, oh, about 150. And I said, how many did you have after 1976? And he said, none. It was like the CIA took the drugs out of the water. So from February of 1975 till about November, December, it started to tail off. And that's when they took these missiles out of North Dakota. They made a negotiated with the Russians, and they started to shut down this anti-ballistic missile unit. And the UFOs just seemed to go away. And so, but it wasn't until 35 years later that I tied in this connection to the missiles in North Dakota, and that was told to me by this aviator who said, I told you, they were coming from the States, and he had mentioned even having a discussion with a pilot, a U.S. Air Force pilot, about one being over a nuclear missile silo, and they had been given the order to ram it. And this guy had pulled out of the formation at the last minute and didn't want to play this game. But they were around these missile silos. And now we know this, but in 75, we really didn't know this. To me, it was just sort of a random event. So in February, the sightings start, the media picks up on the story, and we used to drive around the city. I live in a big city, Winnipeg, which is about 700,000 people. And I said to my friend, I said, you know, why don't we go out and see what these guys are looking at? I didn't really have any interest except that let's go see what it's all about. So he said, okay, we'll go, and we never did go. And then in May of 1975, this would be about 3 months later, there's an event that at that time I thought was random. Now I don't think it's really a random event at all. There was a local TV crew who had gone out, and they had this thing on the ground. They could see it on the ground, and they were trying to film it. They weren't able to get any film. And they went back.
Well, that's interesting. Why not?
It was so far off, or it was like, it wasn't in the sky. Like, they had it on the ground. And for whatever reason, they didn't shoot the first night. And so they went back to the TV studio, and they told the assistant producer, they said, I think we can get it. We want to go out back again tomorrow. And he said, no. He said, nobody's going out. I'm not paying any more overtime. This is absolute nonsense. You guys want to go and chase this stupid thing, you can go on your own time. And so what happened was, these guys were so interested, they were so taken by this thing, that they actually had a bunch of volunteers from this TV studio that actually took a camera, and they didn't have a cameraman, so they used a film editor who'd never shot a camera before, and they went out to try to capture this thing again. And what happened was, there was about 10 witnesses to this, and there was, I think, 4 pilots, there was the editor of the local paper out there, because all these people would spend every night trying to capture this thing on film and do this kind of stuff. So they had it, again, they saw it, it was sort of on the ground, they could see it glowing up and glowing down, and so they left this camera, a big TV camera, on the road, and 2 of the cars, one went 1 mile north of it, one went 1 mile south of it, and they were going to try to come to where they thought it was and sort of intercept it with these cars. And the car on the north side had gone down, and they made the cut across where they thought this thing had been sitting on the ground. And it actually, we measured, it was about 8.25 miles from where the camera was. And they came across, and the editor of the paper, who had his pilot's license and everything, basically said, suddenly, there it was, sitting there behind a set of trees. And where all this happened in Manitoba is an area where there basically are no trees. I mean, it's as flat as can be. It's one of the flattest areas in the world, and there really are no trees. It's just grain farms, massive grain farms. And so they had a windrow of trees where they would grow a row of trees where they'd try to catch the snow during the winter. And this thing was in behind this row of trees, but it was sticking up above the trees, and it was on an angle, like a 45-degree angle, like an old drive-in movie screen. And it wasn't touching the ground. And this is the most bizarre thing. They said it was 50 feet high, it was blood red, and it was the classic type saucer where it was sitting there. And so they quickly started to get their perspective, because they're out in the middle of nowhere. There's no real towns around where this was. And they're looking at microwave towers and stuff to try to figure out exactly where they are on the countryside, so they can come back next day and see if there's any radiation on the ground, which they did find the next morning. They brought in the planetarium in Winnipeg, had gone out with their people and actually detected that where this thing had been sitting on the ground. So anyway, they looked around to see where it was, and then they looked back, and it was gone. It had disappeared. They thought it had disappeared. Meanwhile, it's 8.25 miles away. This guy, this TV editor, film editor, is looking in the viewfinder of the camera, and this is something that I didn't realize till 35 years later. I don't think this is random at all. So he sees this thing, and it glows up. It gets brighter, and it goes down, gets brighter, goes down, and then he says, I got to get something on film. So he says, the next time this thing starts to glow, I'm going to shoot the camera. I'm going to try to get something. And it was almost like the intelligence behind the phenomena said, are you ready to shoot? Because as he pushes the trigger, this thing jumps in the air. And this is on a documentary called, if you remember, the 1988 UFO Cover-Up Live, this documentary that was rumored to have been backed by the CIA, where they introduced the Avery and the live alien idea and all these bizarre ideas. Area 51 is put on this documentary. This is about 6 months before it actually becomes public.
I do remember. And yeah. But before we go on, we got to take a little bit of a break for our Free Dreamlanders. Free Dreamlanders, subscribe today and you will not hear any more ads.
UnknownCountry.com. Daily news you can't get elsewhere. A powerful search engine that can open your mind to a world of wonderful news stories dating back 15 years. An insight section like no other. Whitley Strieber's legendary Dreamland. Jeremy Vaney's thoughtful, provocative The Experience. A weekly newsletter, and all for free. But there's much, much more. A huge audio archive filled with quality programming and information you cannot get elsewhere. A full hour of Dreamland and The Experience every week, all commercial-free. Frequent special interviews, material you will never hear elsewhere. The chance to participate in live chats with Whitley Strieber and join our lively commentary sections throughout the site. Go to Unknown Country and subscribe today from $4.95 a month. Incredible information, a great deal. You need us, and we need you. Ever wonder what the Close Encounter experience is all about? Think you know what it's about? When you open Whitley and Ann Strieber's Immortal Communion Letters, you're going to experience a whole new vision. Not something being told to us by researchers and theorists, but the actual testimony of people who came face to face with this unknown. Unforgettable. And the book is only $3.99 at Strieber.com.
We're back with Grant Cameron discussing the extraordinary Charlie Red Star UFO event. His book is Charlie Red Star. You could get it by clicking through from the Dreamland page. And please do that if you're going to get the book, because that goes to our Amazon store and we get a few cents too, which we very much need. So do click through from our page. Grant's website is presidentialufo.com. Grant, let's just keep on now. We're in a situation where this enormous number of missiles have just been deployed just a few miles south of where you are, and suddenly this is happening in your area. Now, yeah. Did you actually see it? You did, didn't you?
Yeah. And then that happened after this film was taken. The object jumps in the air. This guy happens to push the camera, the trigger, just as this thing jumps in the air. And what happens is it goes through three frames of film. The first frame, you can see it sitting on the ground. The second frame is what we call a flash frame. So you in 1/24th of a second, just this one frame has this flash frame where you can actually see the horizon. It's the middle of the night, but you can see the horizon and these two huge humps of light on either side of the object. And then the third frame, and you got to remember the camera's 8.25 miles away. In the third frame, it's at the top of the frame. So it's up, some people said 5,000 feet. It jumped in three frames of film. And then he films this thing as it goes across the sky. And it appears in this documentary called UFO Cover-Up Live. And there it just sort of looks like a light in the sky. But if you understand the mechanics, and I go through the mechanics of the film in the book, right, describe the frames and how much it moved in these three frames of film. So it became a viral film. NBC News picked it up. Jalen Hynek came to Winnipeg, got two copies. We don't know what happened to those two copies. He came and got the film. And so when that film went viral in Winnipeg, where I live, then I said to my friend, I said, come on, let's go see what they're looking at, because this story was actually picking up momentum. And later I thought, well, what was the chances that this thing jumped just as the guy was pushing the trigger? And I'm thinking, maybe they actually needed me to go out, because I never would have gone out. If it had not been for that film, I never would have gone out, because it had been 3 months and we'd sort of forgotten about the story. And it was around, but it wasn't a big thing. So that's when we went out and we drove to the town. And I always describe it as buying the lottery ticket. I bought the lottery ticket knowing there's a chance I could win, but knowing I wasn't going to see anything. I wasn't going to win. And we went out there, we drove into town, out of the town, we're looking around and we're looking at stars and planets and trying to figure out, like, what is everybody looking at? And I thought, well, whatever it is, it's not very significant. And then we drove out of town and my friend said, we'll drive back in Carmen, this town, one more time. If we don't see anything, let's go home. I said, fantastic, this is a total waste of time. So we turned to go back into town And then I always describe this thing with that people outside the UFO community really don't understand. There's believing, disbelieving, and then there's knowing. If you have not been in the lab and seen the experiment, all you can do is believe or disbelieve. But if you've been in the lab and you actually see it, you know. And when this thing appeared on the left side of the car, nobody said, is that what they're looking at? I wonder if that's what it was. Everybody just went, there it is. Everybody instantly knew this is what everybody was talking about. It came from the left to the right. It was flying in front of the car, down very, very low. It was maybe 100, 200 feet at the most in the air, very, very low to the ground. And it looked like it was alive. It had this very, very slow pulse to it. Red, it was blood red, and it was slowly pulsing, very, very slowly. And it was like a plasma object. So it was very, very intense plasma type of object. You could see it was longer than it was high, but you couldn't really see the shape of it. And it flew right in front of the car, and it was bobbing up and down. It wasn't sort of flying in a straight line. It was sort of moving up and down like a bobber on a fishing line. And I remember I was just floored. And it was going in behind this set of school buses that were parked outside this town. And I realized within seconds, I was not going to see this thing anymore. So I was jumping out of the car as the car was still moving. Ran across the parking lot and watched this thing slowly move off into the northeast. Like it was burning gas. It wasn't doing anything of any importance or whatever. So I dragged all my friends out two nights later, and I said, oh, man, you got to see this. It'll change your life. I was just ecstatic about this whole thing, dragged all my friends. And there was people all over the countryside, because a lot of people from the city were out there trying to see this thing, and nobody knew really where to sit. So you drive down any back road, and there was people sitting there looking around to see if they could see this thing. And there was 28 people when it first started. And when it finally came, all my friends had gone home. They said, we're going home. We're hungry. They took off. When it finally came, there was 8 people coming. And the second night, this would be 2 nights later, it came directly at us. And it started, there was this flashing, what some kids called, I interviewed some young kids, and they called it the bouncing ping pong ball, where it would jump around in the sky. And as it got closer to us, the flashes got closer and closer together. And all of a sudden, it was this same object I'd seen the first night, this red sort of pulsing thing. And it was very, very low to the ground again. It was coming right at us the second night. And I remember there was a girl in the other car who couldn't see it. So you had people yelling and screaming and cheering, and as this thing was coming at us, and this girl couldn't see it because it was moving around, it was jumping around. She's crying. She says, I can't see it. Someone show me. And everybody was ignoring her. And then there was a guy in the car who had I remember it was when motor drives first came out on cameras. So he had this motor drive that would advance the 35mm film. And I can just remember people yelling, screaming, swearing, this girl's crying, and I could hear this motor drive as he had this camera on top of the car, and it was going click, zzz, click, zzz, click, zzz. And he was just unloading the camera as this thing was coming towards us. And then it stopped sort of maybe a half a mile away and made a turn, and it headed again off into the northeast, just slowly flying away. And it was at that point I thought, wow, I mean, this could be from like some other planet or something. I was floored. And that was the point when I decided, why is nobody investigating this? I mean, because the rumor was that like half the people in the town had seen this thing. It was all over the place. So I started to interview people, and it would be always the same process. I'd find somebody, I'd say, I heard you saw something. And they'd say, who said I saw something? And I'd say, well, so-and-so said you saw something. Well, it really wasn't anything. Always the same story. Oh, it wasn't anything. And then he was like,
yeah, they're scared. Yeah, scared of being embarrassed.
Yeah, and eventually they would tell you the thing was sitting on the road, it blocked my car. It was some real bizarre story.
Let's just go very briefly back to the girl who couldn't see it. Could she not see it because she simply couldn't see it even though she was looking at it, or was she just out of the line of sight?
Well, before it turned into this red object, it started as a flash. Like it almost looked like a flash cube. Just poof, this flash on the horizon. And I had these kids who were doing science fair projects. They were sitting out in the field, and they said, is that it? And I went, I guess so, because it didn't look like what I saw the first night, but it was very bizarre, this flash. And then it would jump like almost 8 inches in the field of vision. It was jumping around the sky, like not close. It was all over the sky, and it was just this flash, 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 flash. It was jumping around the sky. And as it came closer, the flashes got closer together. So by the time it came, then she could see it. But when it first started,
I understand.
And that's why these kids called it. There was these kids, their parents were totally ostracized. And at one point, I went to interview the parents because they had so many sightings, and the kids were there by themselves. And that's when I went to these kids, and because their parents were so badly ridiculed, I said, well, let's see what these kids say. So I said to them, hey, have you seen, what do you see? And they would say, oh, you know, we'd camp at night, we'd look out the window, and we'd watch the bouncing ping pong ball. And as soon as they said that, I knew what they were talking about. They were talking about this flashing thing that would jump around in the sky. And so I was fascinated. My friends just sort of gave up on it. But I was just determined that somebody had to record this story. And I gathered all these people's stories, and I had some pretty dramatic stories, and put it all together in a book. And nobody really wanted to publish it. And the local publisher, because it was a famous story where I came from, she sort of changed my entire career. She's the one that said to me in my rejection letter, "Mr. Cameron, you may believe in this kind of stuff. Count me among the unbelievers." And I went, wow, I just couldn't believe it. I was floored. And so I gave the manuscript to my sister, who's like the family historian, and I wasn't interested in it at all. And she held it for like 30 years. And then there was a producer in Toronto who wanted a Canadian angle to do a movie, a UFO movie, and she wanted to read the manuscript. She heard about it, so I gave it to her, and she said, oh, I'd like to option this for a movie. And it was actually she who went and got the thing published, because she wanted it with this movie. And if it had been left up to me, I never would have published the book. It was actually her who was pushing the book.
You know, that's such a familiar story. Many, many people have had extraordinary experiences and written about them, but when they come up against the kind of barrier that was in the mind of that publisher, the first publisher, it just kind of stops them cold. It's hard. I have that problem myself, but go ahead.
Yeah, and that's what I've actually started to do now, is I'll come across, because I have a lot of contacts, so I come across a number of experiencers who have some of the most bizarre stories you've ever heard in your life. And then I say, have you written it down? Every experiencer, I say the same thing. Have you written this down for your kids, your grandkids, so they'll know what this is all about? And most people will say, yeah, I wrote it down. I say, did you try to get it published? And they say, I don't know how to do it. So what I say to them is, I'll show you how to do it. I'll take you through the process. We'll help you edit the manuscript, whatever. We won't take any money, and I'll just help you do it. And that's what I'm sort of doing now, is finding these very, very bizarre stories where people have had a book for 5 years where they've never published it, and that's what happened to mine. But it did send me on this career, this sort of a career change, because what happened was I gave up on sightings. I said, well, unless you're there, you can either believe or disbelieve. It really doesn't prove anything. So I said, well, these are like nice stories you can tell your grandchildren when you grow old and gray, but it tells you something's going on, but it really doesn't prove anything. And all I was interested, after I got this big rejection letter from this local publisher, was somebody in the world has to know what I've seen. Somebody out there has to be smarter than me. Somebody has to know. And I started on this this trail, which, again, was not random. What happened was, my father was a pilot for the Canadian government. He flew for the Department of Transport, and actually flew Paul Hellyer around when he was the Minister of Transport.
Interesting. So, we're going to have to take, for the Free Dreamlanders, another brief break. We'll be right back.
An Unknown Country subscription opens a door into a world of mystery and information. Over 200 special interviews where our guests open the doors of their minds to our subscribers. A Dreamland archive going back to 2004. Plus, Whitley's Room, where you will find his talks on The Key and The Path. His original communion hypnosis sessions. Audio versions of many of his books. The inspiring talks on the Bible as you have never heard it discussed before. And above all, his beautiful, inspiring meditations. More special material for subscribers every week. $12.95 gets you 3 months of wonder. Plus, you can subscribe online or by mail.
This is Whitley Strieber. Join us today. Go to unknowncountry.com, click on the subscribe tab, and sign up. $4.95 gets you a month. $12.95, 3 months. $19.75, 6 months. $39.50 a year. Those are not high prices compared to what else you will find on the internet, but there's a huge difference. The difference is our archive is absolutely enormous. We're pushing through 600 editions of Dreamland, plus there are audiobooks of Communion, Superstorm, and others. There is so much in that archive, and it is all easily searchable with the subject cloud to the right on every screen, or with our powerful search engine. You can really get into this hours of fascinating information. Plus, there's weekly chats on Wednesday evening, 7 o'clock Pacific time, that I appear in as often as I can. So get involved. This is fun. It is important. Keep up with what's going on with me. Supernatural's coming out in February, The Next Alien Hunter in April, and the Hunter series, Gail Ann Hurd's Hunter series, starts in April, and it's based on the Alien Hunter, and it is way, way cool. I've seen some of the episodes, and it's going to make a splash, believe you me. Join us today. UnknownCountry.com. It's waiting for you to subscribe and keep it going.
War Day is one of Whitley Strieber's most powerful books. Join him and his co-author Jim Konietka as they travel across the United States devastated by limited nuclear war. This acclaimed novel was originally published in the 1980s, but now that North Korea has said that they can hit the U.S. with nukes, it's more timely than ever. Don't miss this informative, exciting, and convincing testament to the power of the human spirit in challenging times like our own. Get the ebook for $3.99. Go to Strieber.com for this and all of Whitley's great books.
This is Whitley Strieber. We're talking to Grant Cameron about his book and the experience of Charlie Red Star. You can see Grant's work on presidential UFOs. You can get Charlie Red Star by clicking on the Dreamland tab and ordering it from Amazon through our Amazon store. Now, let's get back to where we were. You were right in the middle. I just had to sort of interrupt you, Grant.
Yeah.
So let's just keep going.
Yeah. So what happens is I'm looking for someone who has the answer to what I've experienced. What was that object I saw those first two nights? And I had five close up encounters with the object. But I was interested in who had the answer. And what happens is there's a guy in my father's office who's a radar tech, who my father says, oh, this guy's name is Ernie App. And Ernie's had a sighting, and he wants to talk to you. So I go, good. So I go and talk to him. It's just an ordinary sighting, light in the sky type thing. And then he says, and again, is this random or is this actually planned? He says, you know, if you really want to know what's going on with UFOs, you should study what the Canadian government was doing in the 1950s. I worked with the head guy who ran the Canadian government UFO program. And I go, you did? And there was like only six people that worked for this guy. And this happened to be one of the guys. And he happens to work in my father's office. And so he puts me on to the story of the Canadian government and Wilbur Smith, who ran the Canadian government UFO program, who was an experiencer, who was in contact with an alien all during his career, actually wrote a book called The New Science about what he had been told about how the universe works and how it all operates and stuff like that. And he had died in 1962, and I went and interviewed his wife, who was secretary to the Speaker of the Senate. And that started me on this whole trail of chasing high-level government officials, CIA people, and I started to get some of the answer that people knew what was going on. And then that led me, of course, to the thing where I say experiencers are the people you need to talk to, people who have interacted with the phenomena or with the intelligence behind the phenomena. You can't learn anything by what's happening, lights in the sky, but most experiencers will tell you about their experience and what they've been told. And that was, in the end, where I sort of ended up with this whole quest to see what it was that I had seen in 1975.
And it's a quest that's still very much alive in your life.
Yeah, it still dominates. It's like, I guess a lot of people in ufology, it's an obsession that you really can't shake. And my experience is that most people in the UFO community or their families really aren't really interested. It's something that is caused by an experience or almost like if you get into multiple life scenarios, it may be something that we've agreed to do, that we've come here and this is our mission, which is what I always ask the experiencers. Do you believe you have a mission? And almost every experiencer says the same thing. Oh, yeah, I believe I have a mission.
I know exactly what you're talking about. We are all like that. Now, let's get one of the things that you brought up are these books you're working on with experiencers, and that's a wonderful thing. And so do keep us posted about these, because I know my listeners would be among the first to buy those books once they come out. And yeah. So I wish you all of the best with them. I know Ann Streber, gosh, over the years, read all these letters, and she published a book called The Communion Letters. And the thing that's amazing about all of this is the UFO community has had a kind of unconscious selectivity to its choices as to who to interview and who to put on the record and what to say about their experiences. The real unvarnished experiences are even stranger than Carl Sagan said they would be if they were from involved people from other worlds.
Yeah, yeah. Some of them, that's true. I mean, they are the weirdest stories I've ever heard in my life. You couldn't make this stuff up. You know, people describing events like, you know, most people, like I got dragged into the music thing, the connection to UFOs. So a lot of people know that the Moody Blues were all abducted in 1967. And one of the stories that just pops to mind is a guy who, an entire band abducted in 1972 in Canada, where they abducted the entire audience at one point. It was just like, and this guy tells this story, and you just riveted to this story. And I've heard him tell it numerous times. It's the same way every time, and it's the same thing. It's like, yeah, he's sort of written it down, but no, he hasn't really published it. I said, you've got to publish this story. It's just unbelievable. And that's what I find is that so many of these experiencers are living with these stories where they really don't want to tell anybody. They're unsure. But then once you give them an audience, then they suddenly become like messiahs. Like suddenly they realize they've got this sort of mission and they've got this message to put out, and they sort of blossom. And I've seen a lot of experiencers do that, where they really don't want to talk about it. But once you sort of authenticate the fact that you believe them and this story is for real, and that people might want to hear it, the whole world changes for them. And so I get a good feeling of doing this kind of stuff, as well as putting out the stuff that I still hear. Because I'm trying to be at the highest level possible, like in terms of intelligence and what the government knows and high-level officials, I still get that kind of stuff. And even there, you have high-level government officials. If you have experiencers in the general public, what a lot of people don't realize is there's a lot of high-level government officials who are also experiencers, and they're starting to come forward as well.
That's right, and we're going to be talking more about that in the second half of the show, which is what's up next. So if you are a subscriber to Unknown Country, you can listen to the second half of the show as we talk about some of the very latest information that has been released about portals, what they are, where they go, and who might actually be back engineering them right now. And this is very far from vague speculation. This is much more grounded, as you will find out, insofar as anything about a portal could ever be grounded. But in any case, that's what we're going to be talking about next. And free Dreamlanders, as always, I would like to thank you for being with us. Subscribers, we are going to keep right on right now.
You've been listening to Dreamland. Be sure to tune in again next week. Dreamland is brought to you by UnknownCountry.com and its family of subscribers. Unknown Country was founded by Ann Streber. Our news editor is Matthew Frizzell. Our coordinator is Amy Safrankova. Whitley Streber is your Dreamland host. And I'm your announcer, Ted Alexander. Thank you for listening.